Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carborough. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbiosciences.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's current monthly, that is, Current Science Forums series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. And last but not least, thanks to personal contributions from the faculty, Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Biomanufacturing Research Institute and Technology Enterprise, or BRITE, at North Carolina Central University. BRITE is one of the newest and most innovative biotechnology educational initiatives in the country, and the only formal biotech degree program offered by a North Carolina university. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. William Parker, who is an assistant professor in the Division of Surgical Sciences at Duke University Medical Center. Bill did his undergraduate work at the University of Arkansas Little Rock and received his PhD in chemistry from the University of Nebraska College of Medicine in 1992. He did postdocs at Nebraska and at Duke, and he has been on the faculty at Duke since 1995. Bill's research focus is on the role and function of the human immune system, and over the past several years, he has published some truly remarkable and important findings, all of which we will discuss here on the program. Bill, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thanks very much, Ernie. It's a pleasure to be here.
What led you to focus your research and your interests on the immune system?
Well, my original training was as a biochemist in the chemistry department at Lincoln, Nebraska. As a chemist, I was working with plant proteins, why plants turn green, actually, a specific protein there. And before that, I'd worked on some turtle proteins, how turtles can breathe for so long underwater. So some very interesting proteins. I saw a job ad in Nature just looking. It was from Duke, and some folks were looking for a protein chemist to come look at some proteins in the immune system. So to me, the immune system was no different than turtle blood or to a plant cell, anything like that. So it sounded interesting. I came here to Duke to look at some immune molecules.
And got hooked.
Exactly. I got hooked. It's a great place to come work.
Excellent. Well, you know, it seems like our immune system plays just such an overwhelmingly important role in our health, and all too often in our diseases as well. How much do we know about the system itself? Is there still a great deal to learn? Is it still somewhat of a mystery? Or are we closing in on the type of detailed knowledge that's going to translate into important new therapies?
One of the concerns in the field of immunology is that we haven't come up with so many therapies as we would have hoped, for example, to really affect a cure for autoimmune diseases or allergies.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we can treat those conditions, but we can't always cure them. So, you know, the answer is we don't know what the future holds. We know that it's going to be hopefully possible in the future to really get our immune systems fixed up the way they need to be so that we don't have a lot of the immune problems that we currently have, including food allergies, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But right now, we don't know.
Well, it's going to be interesting to keep an eye on that, your whole field, because so much interesting stuff is emerging.
Right. One of the things that we're really interested in, I'm sure we'll get to talk about this, is just taking a different look at the immune system from an evolutionary perspective, just to see what is our immune system really made to do, and then how has our current environment, or changes in our environment with our culture, affected our immune system.
Absolutely. Well, I know one of your findings that I wanted to kind of start out with that got a lot of attention recently that speaks directly to that, your discovery of the apparent function of the human appendix. And that's an organ that we've all been brought up to believe was vestigial and basically useless. But your investigation of the immune system as it relates to the gut has led you to an entirely different conclusion about that. So tell us the story of that.
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, let me say that if you look through the literature, sort of the evolutionary biology, the phylogeny of the appendix, or where it occurs in different species, and you can go all the way back to the early 1900s. 1912, Arthur Keith, a well-known physician at that time, wrote a great paper on that. And not everybody agreed that the appendix was just a vestige, but nobody knew what it was for, so perhaps the best argument was that it was a vestige. On the other hand, if you look, say, at rodents, for example, and we've just completed a study, and we've got this in press now, it's about to be published in the Journal of Evolutionary Biology, we looked at 11 different families of rodents, and 8 of those families you find species that have an appendix. So the appendix is around.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
It's there, and there wasn't a lot of good evidence that it was a vestige, but since we didn't know what it was for, yeah, it seemed like it may be a vestige. So that being said, yeah, a lot of tracking around and how the immune system works with a bacteria and finding some new things, a lot of serendipity involved. We did figure out what the appendix is for. We're excited about that.
So in your opinion at this point, what is it for? And, you know, tell us the larger story about the biofilms and the gut and everything, because that's very, very interesting.
Sure, sure. We had been looking at the immune system. We came here to work in transplant immunology, and the molecules that were sort of causing us problems with organ rejection were the same molecules that interacted with bacteria. So the logical thing to do is to look at the molecules and how those interacted with the bacteria. In doing that, in 1996, we came upon the idea. It seemed sort of obvious at the time. The conclusion was inescapable that the immune system was supporting the growth of bacteria in the gut. And this was it was a new idea, really. In fact, the old paradigm was quite the opposite, where the immune system was just antibacterial, period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And talking with a lot of microbiologists and ecologists, that idea really didn't make much sense, but it's what we had at the time. We pursued that for quite a while and eventually determined that, indeed, the immune system, the major molecules, in fact, probably the two major molecules produced by the immune system, were supporting growths of biofilms along, or bacterial biofilms along the epithelium or the inner lining of the gut. And I was working with Randy Bollinger at the time, and he was a general surgeon at Duke, and one of the things that he did on a routine basis was take out people's appendices that were inflamed.
Mm-hmm.
So one day we were sitting in the group meeting, and you know, we already knew where the biofilms were. They were up near where the appendix was, and we already knew that the immune system was supporting these bacteria. And in fact, if you looked around at the world around us, you know, coral reefs and plant roots and, you know, everything you can find, squids, for example, just odd species here and there, they all support bacterial growth and biofilm. So it's not a shock. We were sitting in our group meeting one day, and Randy just suddenly says, you know, I bet that's what the appendix is for. And then, of course, everybody, you know, just he didn't have to say anything beyond that. It was, just seemed obvious from there on. And in hindsight, if you think that the immune system is antibacterial, you really can't come up with a function for that little worm-like structure there. It doesn't make any sense. Why would it be like that? But as soon as you realize that, number one, the bacteria are very important, and we need those. And then number two, and of course, we have to talk about changes in our culture, which have really affected this. But in general, if you're living in a, say, a Stone Age society, you need your bacteria. If you can look at third world today, and you can see they need their bacteria. It became obvious. It was a very fun, just accidental thing that we tripped over.
So it's these are the bacteria in the gut that we have a synergistic relationship with, that we literally could not survive without their existence in our system.
Well, it's a little bit the chicken and the egg, honestly. You can't we can raise mice in a bubble with no bacteria whatsoever, but it's a lot of work. And if any bacteria gets in there, the mice, the immune system will sort of embrace it. Even if you put a bacteria which is normally very pathogenic, that causes disease, still it will colonize those mice, and the mice will adapt to it. The immune system adapts, the bacteria adapts to the mouse. So you really can't have one without the other. The bacteria sort of come along with us. And you see that, you know, from amphibians all the way up to every single mammal on planet Earth.
And the populations in our gut, it's really quite extraordinarily huge, is it not?
It is extremely huge. There's probably over 100 different species in there, and they all have their little niches. It's very well balanced, and typically that balance prevents an invasive microorganism from coming in and getting established, because all the niches are occupied very tightly.
So the theoretical function of the appendix is to promote those bacteria and even replace that system in the case of it getting wiped out by something like dysentery.
Exactly correct. If you look in third world countries, you see that dysentery is one of the leading causes of death in those countries, and it plays in with, you know, not having a clean water supply like we have, not having adequate nutrition. So one round of dysentery, where it might not be a big deal to us, could be a very life-threatening problem over there. And that's why, for example, I think just a few years ago, if you look at the World Health Report, you'll see that dysentery is the leading cause of death, and for example, in Southeast Asia, in the most populated areas. So this is something that we really don't have to deal with because of our culture. Whereas in previous cultures, before the Industrial Revolution, before water supplies, our CDC, certainly our Center for Disease Control is important. You know, all of those things have helped us not to need our appendix, really.
So really, the conventional wisdom about the appendix, that it's vestigial, useless, is really only potentially even true in the context of first world areas like ours, where it's unlikely you're going to catch a diarrheal disease such as dysentery, which would void the gut of the beneficial flora and call the storehouse from the appendix into use.
Exactly. And we know that the biofilms are routinely being grown and reshed from that little worm-like structure. So what happens then is, when an infectious organism comes in, the system gets flushed out as a defensive response, then the bacteria that have been stored in that appendix, that are constantly being grown and shed, they'll then populate you know, start sort of reboot the system, re-inoculate the system with the good bacteria, the beneficial bacteria.
And the appendix is kind of isolated for that very reason, right?
Apparently so. And we say apparently because if you think about actually trying to do an experiment to test this, it's not trivial. You'd have to take, you know, hundreds of, you'd first have to find a species that has an appendix that you could experiment on. And you'd have to do, you know, hundreds of operations, take the appendix out of some, and then do a sham operation or, you know, operate on the others but don't take the appendix out. And then you'd have to release them and monitor survival rate in the face of, you know, whatever kinds of epidemics they might happen to have. So we're not 100%. It's not proven, let's put it that way. Although now we're getting more and more evidence from, especially looking at it from an evolutionary biology perspective. That's probably our most direct evidence, in fact, right now, that we do have a need for that appendix. In fact, I can tell you based on work that I did with Heather Smith out at Arizona that either, you know, the appendix has evolved very, very early in primate evolution and maybe even before that, or it's evolved independently five different times. So, and it's not, there was an old idea that the appendix sort of appears as your cecum disappears. And the cecum is that big blind pouch there that's primarily a digestive organ. And that's actually not true. We know, for example, there's a type of squirrel in Africa which has a huge cecum, but it also has a very well-shaped appendix, much like the human appendix. So it's the bottom line is, yeah, everything gets flushed out. You get some bacteria shed back out into the system. And our whole idea that it was a vestige was pretty short-sighted, I guess, just looking at our own culture and what happens when our surgeons take the appendix out. Because I need to be clear about this up front. If your appendix gets inflamed, you have to get it taken out. So don't think that, you know, it has a function. You know, the last thing we want to do is for somebody to get hurt because they're trying to hang on to the appendix. It is true. It's proven in our culture. It has no function, and it can kill you probably about 50% of the time if it gets inflamed and you don't take it out.
Absolutely. Well, has anyone ever taken a look at, in people who have had these diarrheal diseases and compared their outcomes based on whether or not they still had an appendix? Maybe there's a grant idea for you.
Right. So that's an intriguing question. A lot of people have asked me, for example, what happens if you get your appendix taken out and then go over to a third world country? And that's a fairly easy one to answer. First of all, we're not on the typical American, at least, is not on the verge of starvation. So we have some reserves. Plus, when we go to a third world country, we don't drink the water. We don't go drink contaminated well water or river water. We don't really engage in that culture. And we have access to all the medicine we need.
Sure.
You know, should there be any problem. Back to your question about people with their appendix out versus people without their appendix out and how do they recover from diarrheal illness. There's really two issues to consider there. One is that bacteria get passed around a lot. It's sort of a little bit gross and disgusting, but as long as your whole tribe or community doesn't get contaminated water, then you're probably going to be able to pick up your bacteria from somewhere else. Then a second issue is that those people who have their appendix taken out, probably something is different about those folks than the folks who did not get their appendix taken out. And we know from some nice work, a fellow named David Barker, who's a British epidemiologist, sort of why, at least to a large extent, we get appendicitis in our developed countries. And it has a lot to the same reasons we get allergies and autoimmune diseases. But the bottom line is that there's no fair experiment that you can look at to see what is the appendix really doing in our culture. It's virtually impossible. You really need to go catch a bunch of rodents and do that experiment if you want to do it.
Sure. Well, you know, your explanation of its potential function, you know, just seems, and, you know, this is the non-scientist speaking, it seems quite elegant. And it just seems to make a whole heck of a lot of sense.
Well, thanks. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from the scientific community as well, because when you start looking at other scientific approaches independent of immunology, for example, the evolutionary biology and the microbiology, Mm-hmm. You see everything's pointing in the same direction. We've just done a study with Sonic Coates in Africa looking at mole rats. And mole rats, turns out, have a very nice appendix. It's just as well-formed as a human appendix. And we can see there from a microbiologist's perspective that it does indeed look like that appendix is really just a sort of a cultivation area for bacteria.
How about that? Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch your work evolve, and other people, I'm sure, are getting on board with this, and see where it all goes.
Well, we published several papers in earlier in this decade just pointing out that the immune system is pro-microbial, or in other words, it's supporting microbes in the gut, and those papers have been very well cited.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it does make a lot of sense, and other investigators have sort of taken up this idea and run with it, and they have expertise is much different than mine. They'll be able to run in different places than I have, which is very exciting. That's probably the most exciting part.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned appendicitis.
Yes.
And I understand that you know, part of your investigation of the gut biofilms and the appendix actually also leads to a potential explanation of appendicitis, which ties in directly to the next major area of your research that I wanted you to describe, which is the so-called hygiene hypothesis. That is something that I think most people have at least heard about over the last several years. Tell us about that, and let's explore that hygiene hypothesis.
Okay, well, the hygiene hypothesis is about 20 years old. A guy named David Strachan came up with that. He's a British epidemiologist, just like David Barker, who mm-hmm. worked on the causes of appendicitis. So you got two Davids, both British, and both in the 1980s working on what is causing our immune system to do the things that it's not supposed to do. Both of them came to the same conclusion, which was that if we're too clean, if we get rid of too much dirt, and I'm not talking about dust around the house or something like that, I'm talking about the kind of dirt that you would probably encounter if you lived in a log cabin, say. You know, you don't have a big dust problem there. You might have a big, you know, sand and dirt problem. A lot of parasites from drinking the water, especially parasites.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things have been largely wiped out, giving the immune system nothing to do. So if there's any young people here, I don't want to offend them, but we could think of it as a teenager, for example. Give the teenager nothing to do, and they're very likely to find something stupid to do. So that's sort of what the immune system does. It's designed, it's evolved to react to these things, and it's
and in evolutionary terms, the new or the extreme hygiene that we have, you know, in our society is really a relatively new phenomenon.
Oh, it's incredibly new. There's been no biological evolution since we've developed this hygiene. We know, for example, that all parasites turn down the immune system, and that parasites are ubiquitous. They are everywhere in nature. Even some parasites have parasites. So you take away this component of our environment, which naturally turns down the immune system, and the immune system is going to be unnaturally revved up. It's going to be overexcited.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this has resulted in, I had some stats from some of your publications, 50 million people in the U.S. have allergies.
Yes, some form of allergies at some time or another, yes.
11 million with food allergies. Peanut allergies doubled between 1998 and 2002 in children under 5. And, you know, today we hear about so many measures to protect kids from peanut exposure. 8 million people apparently have autoimmune diseases, such as lupus, insulin-dependent diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma and psoriasis and other diseases like that. It's obvious from those kind of statistics that, as you say, our immune systems are just in overdrive.
Yes, and back to your very first question, you know, what do we know about the immune system? You know, there's several major things that we don't know. For example, we don't know how much of this immune reactivity gets passed on from mother to offspring. You know, how much is it that it's my hygiene versus the hygiene that my mother had? You know, a lot of things get passed through the placenta, especially immunological components.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a tremendous amount we don't know. What we do hope is that we will be able to modulate the immune system in some kind of reasonably effective way to reduce that overreactivity.
So I understand that actually that there's also a hypothesis that children born via C-section may be more prone to allergies, not having been exposed to some of the bacteria in the mother's birth canal. That's fascinating.
Yes, those are just normal bacteria that you're looking at there, too. So we know that those normal bacteria are very important for the development of your immune system. It again goes back to the chicken and egg issue, that they both sort of go together. You can't have one without the other. And what we're finding, and I'd say we, it's not me, I haven't done this work, but it's well established now that some of these kids born by C-section are just going home with no more bacteria than what they've happened to pick up off a nurse's skin or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they really, you know, they need to get colonized with the normal bacteria that exist in their mother's gut, which is the natural way. If you think about where the birth canal is and how it's located, pretty much any natural childbirth is going to get you a nice, good inoculation with those bacteria that you need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if your child is born by C-section, do you take them out and roll them around in the mud a little bit?
Or? Well, not being a medical doctor, I can't give any medical advice.
Let's not do that. I got to know what to tell my kids. Both of my daughters were born via C-section, and one actually has considerable allergy issues, not surprisingly, I guess. And, of course, we know that some of those things tend to be hereditary as well.
Yes, it's sort of like smoking cigarettes. You know, we know that if you smoke a cigarette, you're more likely to get lung cancer, just like if you're born in a very hygienic environment or if you enter one, you're much more likely to get allergy and autoimmune disease. But we don't know why one person gets cancer and one doesn't, or it's one of the things that we're just beginning to learn now. So and it would be silly to think that there's only this one factor of the hygiene. You know, we've changed our diet. Stress is very, very interesting. So if you look at caveman stress, Neolithic stress, the reason why we have stress is just to drive our body to, to run or to fight, you know, the fight or flight or freeze syndrome. And we just don't get to exercise that anymore. We live with a lot of chronic stress that even though a caveman might have had to deal with a saber-toothed tiger, he got to deal with it. He didn't just sit and stew on that. So we know stress has a profound effect on the immune system. And it's not so much the natural kind of stress that you find out in nature where, you know, something is chasing you and you just run like crazy. That kind of thing relieves stress.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
more a thing of you're sitting in your office and you get this phone call and you're in big trouble and the thing you get to do about it is sit in your office some more. That's basically it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly the immune system is a primary example of what we're learning more and more about as a mind-body connection.
Yes, it's tied in with the endocrine system. Just an exquisite tie-in. Again, I certainly don't know much about that, and that's mm-hmm. a field that's just now opening up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
Well, Bill, describe your experimental work regarding the hygiene hypothesis, because it's just wonderful. You actually compare the immune systems in wild rats and lab-grown rats. Now, how do you go about catching enough wild rats to make this a good sample?
Well, that's an excellent question. The trouble is more with our lab rats of making them a good sample, because lab rats are inbred. So you can examine 20 different lab rats, and genetically you're really only looking at one individual.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to do is look at a lot of different strains of lab rats to sort of get a big picture of what's going on in our lab rats. The wild rats are not that hard to catch if you know where to go. And there are certain caveats. You have to learn a lot about wild rats. I grew up on a little bit of a farm out in a rural area, and we had some rats around. So I got some experience as a youngster on rat behavior. As long as you can eliminate their food source and get them to search for a new food source, then you can catch them pretty easily. I can feed them gourmet food, and one of their favorite, you know, there's a lot of biologists listening, so I'll go ahead and just be blunt here. One of their favorite foods is dog poop. So, yes. So if you can feed them gourmet food, but if you don't get rid of that dog poop, they will not switch to the gourmet food. They creatures of habit. It's a good survival technique. You go with what you know. You know that the dog poop is safe. So if that's the main thing, is we try to talk to folks, get them to take away whatever the rats have been eating, and then we can catch their rats for them, and we have a good time. Now, right now, we're not catching any rats. We're in a process of, you can get a tremendous amount of data from one wild rat. So our free rat catching service is not up and running at the very moment. There are plenty of rats around in the area.
Where do you go to get them when you do?
Well, it's by word of mouth. So we go to different spots. Particularly, we're looking for different environments of the rat just to make sure it's not, for example, if we go to somewhere where they're eating a lot of grain that the farmers are trying to feed to their animals, we want to make sure that it's not just because of the grain. We'll go to a place where they're eating garbage. We'll go to a place where they're eating grain. We'll go to the place where they're stealing dog food. So they have a very fairly consistent diet there. Mm-hmm. And we'll go to places where they're eating dog poop. You know, just different kind. We'll get all different kinds of diets. And what we find when we look at different populations of lab rats around North Carolina with different diets, then we compare those with different strains of lab rat, we see very, very consistent and very, very substantial changes or differences between those two populations of animals.
In their immune systems.
In their immune system, yes. Huge differences. In fact, in a nutshell, what you find is that the wild rats have a very, very active immune system. In other words, there's a lot that's going on there, a lot of things are being done by the immune system compared to the lab rats. But at the same time, it's almost a paradox, but it does make sense. At the same time, the wild rats have a very unresponsive immune system compared to the lab rats. So they're, number one, more active, number two, less responsive. So if you go back to this analogy with a teenager, you've given the teenager plenty to do, and the teenager is very, very active. Mm-hmm. So the teenager is not going to do anything stupid.
Okay, so ultimately these experiments kind of show the existence of the hygiene hypothesis in microcosm in an experimental setting. That's kind of what it's all about, right? You look hesitant.
Yeah, so I would hesitate to say that we've proven the hygiene hypothesis is true. I mean,
In science, we never use that word, right?
Right. Well, no, we can prove some things, I suppose. But in fact, the hygiene hypothesis probably does not need proof. In fact, it's only called the hypothesis probably because it sounds cool, you know, the hygiene hypothesis. You know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's really a theoretical framework now that we use to look at how our immune system is reacting. There's no real questions left about the hygiene hypothesis, even though it's called, misleadingly, the hygiene hypothesis.
I see. Mm-hmm.
You could call it the hygiene theory, but it's not just one theory. There's so many things going on there. It's like evolutionary biology. There's just a tremendous number of things that are contained within that, so you wouldn't just call it one theory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that being said, we're not trying to prove the hygiene hypothesis. We're more trying to track down what are the underpinnings in the immune system that are causing these increases in allergies and autoimmune diseases. So in other words, how is our immune system different than the way it should be? And that's something you can't observe unless you have a naturally occurring population. If you think about it, there's no experiment that you can do in a lab rat unless you tried to give him, you know, 20 different parasites. There's a study that shows that wild rats have up to 20 different species of parasite each. So it's just difficult to do in the normal way that scientists do things, which is take a lab rat, mm-hmm. alter one thing, and see what happens. And what we're finding is that these huge differences might be very difficult to mimic with a drug or something. So more what we're thinking about is maybe we need some kind of therapy, sort of like a vaccine, only different in some ways. We need a parasite, maybe, a domesticated parasite, if you will, to put in our body to give our immune system something to do. And we can do that in a controlled fashion. That's the idea behind domesticating a parasite, so that it's not going to cause us any problems, mm-hmm. but it's going to keep our immune system occupied the way that it is evolved to be, so that then it doesn't start reacting with our own DNA and causing lupus. It doesn't start reacting with a pollen grain and causing hay fever,
sure,
or allergy.
That sounds very much like the concept behind the vaccines.
It's very similar. The fundamental difference would be a vaccine, of course, is designed to rev up your immune system against a certain thing, so that if it sees that particular thing again, it will just destroy it. In this case, parasites are evolved exquisitely so that our immune system cannot destroy them. It sort of lives in stasis with this balance. And that's what this kind of therapeutic would be conceptually. Mm-hmm. It's been used for inflammatory bowel diseases quite successfully already. You know, you take a little whipworm that doesn't cause disease, you infect the GI tract, and you can tune down the immune system so that inflammatory bowel disease goes away in many patients. That study has already been done.
Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, that was done in Iowa.
That's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is. You have a choice. You can drink those parasite eggs, or you can get your colon cut out.
Oh, gosh, that's not much of a choice.
No, it's not much. I would drink the eggs, I think.
I think so. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Bill Parker, and Bill is an assistant professor in the Division of Surgical Sciences at Duke University Medical Center, and Bill is, as I'm sure you have gathered, an immunologist. Bill, the human immune system, you've obviously learned a lot from the rats,
yes,
among many other things. Is it something that's imprinted in the individual during early development, or is one's immune system subject to change even as an adult? Can it be retrained? How does that work? Is it fluid?
What we do, I'll give you one example that goes along with what we've been talking about, the hygiene hypothesis. We know that when running water and clean water supplies move into an area that previously did not have those, there can be an epidemic of appendicitis. We know that when people leave third world countries and come into developed countries, they, as a whole, can get a surge in the rate of appendicitis. So, yes. The appendix is an immune organ. We know that part of its overreactivity causing appendicitis is due to the hygiene factor. So, yes, at least as far as the hygiene goes, you can still, as an adult, modulate your immune system to a certain degree. That is one of the big questions that we do not have an answer for, though. We don't know to what extent that can be modulated as an adult versus to what extent that has to be handled very early on in early childhood. That being said, I think there is a genetic component to it. Like I said, we as a species are evolved so that our immune system expects those parasites, for example, to be there. Mm-hmm. And if they're not there, we as a species are potentially going to have problems with that. And I think that's what we're seeing.
I see. So is part of your work, characterizing that relationship? And trying to figure out what the immune system is looking for, in a sense?
That is an intriguing question. So, no, I would say that, first of all, there's several excellent scientists looking at how parasites tune down our immune system. But we don't do that.
Okay.
What we're looking at, by the way, that is exquisite. It's exquisite how the parasite is designed to work with the immune system. And what we're saying with the hygiene hypothesis is that the immune system is dependent on being tuned down by those parasites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what we're more interested in is seeing what is a normal immune system. What should our immune systems look like? That's what we're doing with these wild animals. We've done some work looking at samples taken from humans in third world populations. There's a limited amount we can do with that because, for example, when we catch a wild rat, I've got a team of four or five people. We've got literally millions of dollars worth of instrumentation that we're using to analyze the samples taken from a wild rat, and we can't take those things over to a third world country. Mm-hmm. So the rat does serve as an excellent model, we think. And if we can figure out what those changes are, we can see this is what we need to do to our immune system to get it back to normal. It needs to look more like this, which is as yet fairly uncharacterized, versus what we see in you and I who live in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there any possibility of more experimentation or investigation in humans, in that even here there are, you know, even though we have 50 million people with allergies, we have, you know, 250 million without. You know, we have many people who apparently at least have relatively normally functioning immune systems.
That goes back to the question of, you know, why do some people that are smoking, they don't get lung cancer? And then that, it's a complex, it's potentially very complex, you know, partially genetics, maybe a number of other factors as well. So all we can really do is look at the overall numbers and see if you're hygienic, you know, you tend to get these things. Now, that being said, I mentioned inflammatory bowel disease earlier, and in fact, it's a porcine whipworm that they use to treat that. You can Google search that and find a number of excellent references on how, and it doesn't work for everybody, but it works for a lot of folks. The way that they got onto that was some epidemiologist figured out that if you have these little pinworms, then you don't get inflammatory bowel disease, and there were certain populations which did not have them. So the answer to your question is yes, you're dead on the money. There are some things that we can tell pretty well just by looking at the population around in the United States, because we haven't totally eliminated parasites. But once the parasites are totally gone, then there's no more way to study the effects of hygiene per se, at least as far as the parasites are concerned.
Well, your example of the parasites and the inflammatory bowel disease is fascinating. Are there other therapies like that on the horizon, either therapeutic or preventative?
You know, there's a lot of rumors. So, okay. I'm privy to some of those rumors, and I think people are very intensely working on this. And they are working on it, but with the understanding that it's not mainstream.
Yeah,
because it's still mainstream.
Say ingesting parasites is not mainstream.
Right, it's not mainstream. The mainstream thing is to, you know, spend $1 billion and make a new drug and then try the drug. But the bottom line there is that we're really trying to recapitulate with our drugs a whole living organism. That parasite is a complex thing. I mean, it has its own DNA. Its DNA has evolved exquisitely to interact with our immune system and tune it down. So we may be able to reinvent a living organism therapeutically, but it'd be easier just to go ahead and use what's there already. In my opinion, that's of course strictly an opinion.
Sure,
but you know, I'm kind of happy with that opinion.
Right. Well, Bill, you know, I'd like to. We've got just a few minutes left this morning, and I certainly want to talk about some of the other work that you've done, which
is
equally fascinating. Specifically, I would like to get you to describe to us your findings related to the association you discovered between gastroesophageal reflux disease, or GERD, and asthma.
Okay, so that project I did with Xu Lin. He's one of the leading lung transplant surgeons in the country, along with Dwayne Davis, both at Duke. And I think it was Dwayne that first looked at, he was looking at his lung transplant patients, and he said, you know, I think if we breathe a little bit of gastric fluid into the lung, I think it's causing us a real problem, sort of teeing off the immune system, if you will. And Xu and I began looking at what would have, you know, what happens in the asthmatic population. And there's already 50 reports per year linking asthma with gastroesophageal reflux disease. And there's a couple of different ways that gastroesophageal reflux disease might affect asthma. One of the most obvious ways is when that acid comes up into the esophagus, a little bit of it can get into the lung, We call that microaspiration.
Mm-hmm. And so you're breathing in tiny amounts.
You're breathing, if it's coming up into the esophagus, yeah. If it's mm-hmm. coming up that high, you're going to be breathing in tiny amounts. And you might not even know it. It might happen a lot, especially these kinds of things happen while people are sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
What we did then, or I should say Shu Lin was the lead on this team, and I was working in the lab with him, is that we took a model, an experimental model for asthma, and just looked at the effects of the aspiration of gastric fluid in that model. And in humans, it's a very difficult experiment to do. What's recently been done in humans out at Duke specifically is to look at the effects of blocking acid production. You don't actually block the reflux. You block the disease because what we think of as the disease is caused in large part by the acid. That's what eats the lining of the esophagus. If you block the acid, though, it doesn't seem to have much effect on the asthma. Hmm. But keep in mind, you're still getting the reflux. And what we found in all of our experimental models is that the most important thing is not the acid per se. It's actually those little tiny particles of food, probably food, that's be the main. There's other particles that would be in the stomach, but it's probably the food that gets into the lung. And particles of food really aren't meant to be in the lung. That it recruits a different kind of cell into the lung to get rid of those particles of food, which does not normally belong there. Right now, what we're trying...
And can that result in an inflammatory process?
Definitely an inflammatory process. We see huge changes in the amount of inflammatory-related molecules that are present in the lung.
Mm-hmm.
And we also see some shifts in what we consider to be... less dangerous immune responses into a type of more dangerous or asthma-related immune response. And again, if it's pointing at the food particles more so than the acid, that means it's maybe more difficult to block with a medical intervention. And this sort of gets us back to our evolutionary biology. You know, why are we all of a sudden having all these problems with GERD? Mm-hmm. You know, it has to do with our diet. It has to do with the fact if we're overweight, it has to do with our, exercise and our stress levels, perhaps. All of these things that are in our culture that Stone Age people did not have to deal with, once again, we see they're impacting our immune system. This, but a totally different route. This has nothing to do with parasites. This has to do with, acid or in gastric fluid without acid, if you're on the medication, getting into the lungs.
In reading about this, it sounded like, I think you said somewhere that one of the kind of silver linings of this story is that GERD is actually relatively easy to treat. But from what you're saying now, that doesn't sound like we're quite that much off the hook.
Well, we know that certain lifestyle changes can affect GERD or can decrease GERD, but those same lifestyle changes can also decrease, our propensity for heart disease. For example, we know that we Americans are very bad at avoiding heart disease, even if we know what to do to avoid it. Reflux in general, though, can be prevented by, I'm not advertising for my department or anything, but they are prevented by a certain surgery that prevents the gastric fluid from coming up above the stomach.
I see. So it's it's not as simple as taking a Zantac or whatever.
No, you cannot take a pill to fix that. Mm-hmm. You can block the acid that way,
right?
But not the reflux.
So, do you think that this mechanism may be a pretty significant factor in the etiology of asthma?
I think it probably is. That's why there's those over 50 papers per year linking the two together clinically. And it could be like pollution. It may not cause asthma. It may not initiate it. In fact, asthma is one of those things which falls under the hygiene mm-hmm. category. Mm-hmm. So it may be that our very clean environment causes the propensity for asthma. But like pollution, it's possible that this reflux can make the asthma worse or can trigger asthma once already present.
I see. Do you think that knowledge is getting out into the clinical community, since it is, potentially something that could be useful in the clinical setting?
Well, it's under intense study right now. I know we just finished a big study at Duke looking at what happens if you block the acid. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the findings were that it does not affect the asthma. So the next question is a more difficult question to answer. Do you start doing these surgeries on folks to block, mm-hmm. The reflux if they are having huge problems with their asthma? And how do you know that those huge problems are related to the microaspiration? So it's a tricky problem. The safe thing to do is just to do things, exercise, diet properly, relieve stress that the medical community's always been saying to do.
Sure.
That'll help out with these general problems with the immune system.
And those measures are going to help across the board.
Oh, absolutely. They help the cardiovascular system, certainly.
Okay. Well, Bill, I want to also ask you, and we've got a few minutes left yet, about some of the basic scientific research that your lab is involved with, exploring protein folding.
Okay.
Now, this is, not as sexy as the appendix, perhaps, but it's pretty complex. But can you explain for us in relatively simple terms what you are researching in that area and why the folding of a protein is so intrinsically important to its function?
Okay, so by asking me that, I know that you know that protein folding is very important.
Yes.
Yes. So the bottom line is this. We know how organisms are made. We know that how a cell is constructed, and it starts out with the DNA, which it produces RNA, which then produces protein, and the protein produces function.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you look at science fiction, say Star Trek, for example, where they just plug in the DNA and they automatically know how the whole entire cell functions. We're not far away from that, with one exception. There's one big leap that we don't know. So if you gave me the sequence of a DNA, and I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but not too badly, you give me the sequence of the DNA, we can figure out what the RNA looks like, and we can even figure out what the amino acid sequence is. But we cannot figure out the function, because we have no idea right now, just starting with an amino acid sequence, how it gets to its final shape, which will, in large part, tell us what its function is. Now, we haven't really tried that because it's so hard to figure out their shape that by the time we get their shape, we already know their function nowadays.
Sure.
But the bottom...
It's a big step forward to actually characterize the shape of an individual protein.
It's
right?
A huge step. There's mm-hmm. very few of those that get done every year for new proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the big unknown. That's the bottleneck in our biochemistry and our understanding the fundamental workings of the cell, of our body. It's how does the protein get to its shape? So it turns out this Russian biophysicist back in the 1970s published a theory that all proteins fold via the same sort of universal conserved mechanism. And it's to get into the details of that, I'd need a lot of pieces of paper and probably wear through three or four crayons. But the bottom line there is that our technology is not good enough right now to actually see what might be going on in those early folding steps. We need to look at just a few microseconds of time after something starts to fold up. And that's very risky. It's just very difficult, and
sure.
It's a hard experiment to try.
Mm-hmm.
I think right now, along with F.A. Chin out in California, we have the world's record for looking at a protein with this incredible time resolution. But we picked our protein. It was a special protein. It's one of the proteins that helps plants turn green. And for reasons, again, which are very complicated, unfortunately, we can't look at universal mechanisms of protein folding with that protein. We've got to do it with some other proteins, which are harder to observe. So I'm going out to Berkeley again with FHN just in a couple of 3 weeks to try yet another experiment, just trying to find out if we can see this thing that was proposed by Valerie Lim going on at very early time frames. And if we can get it, we've done a tremendous number of computational studies to point us mm-hmm. to the idea that Valerie Lim is right. He had it on. He had it correct.
So what does that, if we take the leap of faith and assume that you're going to nail this down, what does that mean? What does that tell us?
Well, that'll allow the biochemist to look at a sequence of DNA and then transform that into an actual folded protein. Now, just if Valerie Lim is right, then that gives us the starting point for that. It doesn't give us the end point, because there's still a lot of work to be done, but it tells us this is how it fundamentally works. And then from there, we can go ahead and sort out the general rules of how it works. Then we can look at, say, we find a new species. We look at their DNA, and those can be, you know, assuming a lot of computational science.
Mm-hmm.
You can then figure out how do the proteins look. And from that, you can figure out what they do, how they're interacting, so on and so forth.
So it's like a key to the whole puzzle.
It is definitely a key to the whole puzzle, from getting us to where we are now to sort of being in your Star Trek type science, where you can just look at it and see how it fits together and works.
No, that's amazing. In a couple of years, you're going to come back on and tell us all about how you discovered all that.
You know, I would love to be able to do that. You know how science is. You never know
if
you've got it right or not. So we'll see.
Well, Bill, very briefly, where is your research headed at this point?
Very briefly, the main thing, my main passion right now is to develop a model by which we can look at animals in a laboratory animals, and we can move them into a wild-like condition. That'll help us control our studies a lot more. We need to build a facility where we can have, essentially, you could think of it as an artificial sewer, where our, you know, where we have complete control over everything, and we can study the animal's immune system that way.
So you're going to be bringing in the dog poop and feeding it to the lab rats.
Whatever it takes, yeah. We need to control food. We need to control stress, all kinds of variables, so we can just look at hygiene.
Excellent. Well, Bill, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule today to visit with us on Radio In Vivo.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we have got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows, which we update regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, here on volunteer-powered WCOM FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. If you enjoy the program, we do ask that you please make an effort to support this station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. And right now, we are in the process of raising funds for our needs for 2009. So please log on to the WCOM website, and it's a brand new website, WCOMFM.org. Click on the Donate Now button and get the details there on how you can make a small monthly contribution and join our Less Than a Latte Club. For less than just the cost of one latte per week, you can help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. Thanks a lot, and we will catch you next time.